Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 98 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 1077. Okay, so the final paper of the Melchizedek block of papers. Once we dealt with Machiavelli, Melchizedek proper, remember we started in the Orient, and we're ending in the Occident, because that's literally what those two words mean, right? The word Orient means towards the rising sun, Occident means towards the setting sun, right? So we've just, this block of papers is in the order of from sunrise to sunset. You know, it spans a day, as it were, of concept. So here we are, the Melchizedek teachings in the Occident, and we've been playing around towards this as we went through lots of detail about the Hebrews, as we all know, what culminates in the Occident is Christianity, and the Hebrews have a huge say in what ends up being Christianity. And but now we're ready to look at the other elements, the Greeks and the Romans, and see how that works. So we're going to drop back again in time, all the way back to immediately post Machiavelli. And consider what the missionaries encountered as they moved more to the northwest, and actually started to impact into Greece and those environments, those environs. Okay, so I think that's enough said up front. Let's see what they give us for a little preface here.
Paper 98, the Melchizedek Teachings in the Occident. Melchizedek teachings entered Europe along many routes, but chiefly they came by way of Egypt and were embodied in Occidental philosophy after being thoroughly Hellenized and later Christianized. The ideals of the Western world were basically Socratic, and its later religious philosophy became that of Jesus as it was modified and compromised through contact with evolving Occidental philosophy and religion, all of which culminated in the Christian church.
Okay, so just as I was saying, there's another little thumbnail sketch of that. Notice they're reminding you, don't forget about Egypt. That was the other thing that they told us a while back. That's very important as a predicate for the Occident, both kind of in and of itself, and then also as a significant predicate for the Hebrews, as we pointed out many times. So, in other words, when you have when all said and done in Europe, you have the greatest percentage of Andite blood that ended up in Europe, especially in Northern Europe. And it's not surprising that the things that might blend into that eventual context would be the Andite-related elements coming in from around it. Whether those Andite elements are, went over from Samaria into Egypt and then, and then in, or if they're coming over, more from Adamsonite territory over into Greece or whatever it might be. There will be a natural resonance from any part of the world of Andite-related cultural elements to Europe, you know, with its significant andite cultural flavor. Okay, so now, if you think about it, that's all very kind of to be expected, what they're saying there. You know, the one little element we haven't talked about yet they threw there in the middle is, you know, basically Socratic. You know, we're going to be getting to the Greeks here. And notice how they worded that. The ideals of the Western world were basically Socratic. You know, so that's, it's an interesting thing to consider when, you know, in many ways, ideals in and of themselves are a religious element, not a philosophic element. But, you know, what that's reminding you of is like with the Hebrews, you know, they've had this tendency to get so bound into the rituals and the priesthood and, you know, and all kinds of material technique notions, you know, falderal of, you know, of so-called religion, that they can benefit from a little bit more of a pure recognition of ideals coming from the Greeks, you know, to help lift that religious phenomena up out of material considerations, and hence not really religious considerations. Okay, so just, you know, note that little little tidbit that they slipped in there. You know, not to mention that we use a term like religious philosophy. See, you know, you bring in the Greeks, and you can start to really put religion and philosophy together more. If you can, you know, bring in some more genuine religious elements into the Greek philosophic context. And that's certainly, you know, the essence of all that ends up in Christianity. You know, it's still lost in lots of ghost cult ritual and superstition and falderal and whatnot, but it's, you know, it's there. And it's enough that it's powered Western civilization forward to the extent that it has moved out of the morass of the rest of the world's mostly Sangic culture. All right, what else did they give us?
For a long time in Europe, the Salem missionaries carried on their activities, becoming gradually absorbed into many of the cults and ritual groups which periodically arose. Among those who maintained the Salem teachings in the purest form must be mentioned the Cynics. These preachers of faith and trust in God were still functioning in Roman Europe in the first century after Christ, being later incorporated into the newly forming Christian religion.
So you may remember when you get up in part four and they give you a little bit of a survey of the Greek cultural influences that were in play at the time of Jesus, they bring up the Cynics in greater detail there. And you may recall that they mention that in the midst of, you know, more philosophical sorts of ideologies, you have cynicism, which had its roots more as a religious phenomenon than a philosophic phenomenon. As they're reminding you here, that they were, you know, initially inspired by, you know, a more pure preaching from Melchizedek missionaries, but as they're reminding you there, there's a hodgepodge of primitive ideas and stuff in Europe, and so as the Melchizedek missionaries are penetrating in there, you know, it becomes a very heterogeneous phenomenon in short order. You know, so, you know, it's not like the Cynics were holding on to some sort of solid thread of purity coming from Machiavelli to Melchizedek, but nonetheless, you know, it you got a little bit of a boosting of a religiosity into a philosophic context, not just from the best of the that the Hebrews had to offer, like, you know, say, Second Isaiah, but also from the cynics as well.
Do you have any idea why the word cynicism or cynic has come down to us, basically meaning without believing in ideals or without, you know, kind of...
You can actually answer that question yourself if you just... I'll give you a little assignment to go to part four and look at that little block on cynicism and think about, you know, what they say there, some of the basic ideas that they had, and how that can, you can kind of play off of that and get a lowercase c cynicism, just like you get a lowercase s stoicism, you know, by playing off of some of the elements of capitalist, you know, stoicism, you know, same way with the Epicureans, you know, or the skeptics, you know. So yeah, just you can easily figure that out. Just yeah, go take a look at that. It's all a matter of you know, just you know, kind of getting the basics of what they did as a capital C cynics, and just noticing, oh, that little kind of philosophical tendency that they had plays forward as a generic term, you know, to say someone is cynical. Yeah. If you can't sort it out, we'll pick it up, you know, again. But I'm pretty sure that you can sort that one out yourself. So I always encourage you, if it's something that you can figure out, you know, please work on it yourself. You know, I can even remind you where that is. Let's see, it's up here, so you can find it easily. It's in, let's see, what paper is this? Paper 121, section 4. Whole single column, page 1336, to be specific, is where that paragraph is on the cynic. let's see, what else do we need to say about that little paragraph here? Back in the email, back to paper 98. Let's see. Let's see. Yeah. There's an important little element in there. So, you know, when they said the cynics, notice what they say right after that. These preachers of faith and trust in God were still functioning in Roman Europe, etc. Notice the order there. Faith and trust, not trust and faith. We've seen that before. You know, when they give you the five epical revelations, and they give you the, you know, the sort of the core of the third epical revelation, and they say it's trust and faith in that order. That's in that very foundational mode where you're just trying to establish that faint flicker of faith as a foundation and the beginnings of a genuine trust predicated on that foundation. But as the Melchizedek missionaries went out, as we, you know, like I said, we've seen this before, and they remind you by flipping the order, you know, what you're looking for is to actually encourage going beyond that literal, you know, 0 point starting point, you know, and beginning to have more foundationally trust. You know, see, so it's the second word here. And so then you can have a living faith on that foundation. Right? When it's trust and faith, that, you know, when to make faith that foundation, it can't really be very living. It has to be kind of static, as it were, to be a foundation, you know, so you can kind of sit on it, you know, and put the floor of trust on that, you know, on a non-fluid foundation, if you will. Okay. But, you know, once you have that trust, that frees faith up to be more dynamic. It doesn't have to serve as a foundation stone, you know, and it liberates it to be living faith upon that trust foundation. And so they just remind you that as you go forward with the Melchizedek missionaries from Machaventa, the whole point is to, you know, that they were working on, maybe it's unwittingly, right? But nonetheless, the powers that be about it all are working to flip that around and get it to be faith and trust. So you see that there again. And just mentioning the first century after Christ, that's, like I said, you can go up there to part four and see them talking about the Cynic contribution to the times of Jesus. All right, let's see what else they give us here.
Much of the Salem doctrine was spread in Europe by the Jewish mercenary soldiers who fought in so many of the Occidental military struggles. In ancient times, the Jews were famed as much for military valor as for theologic peculiarities.
Okay, so notice it's just a little paragraph, just a little kind of a almost footnote sort of a comment, but it's an important element for them to remind you of that, how we progress kind of in spite of ourselves in these early stages, and it's all, to a degree kind of unwitting. It's not like you have sort of definitive, religious missionaries going out from Palestine and bringing this into Europe. I mean, it's sort of at the opposite end of the spectrum, right? It's mercenaries that are spreading it. So, that's the vast conspiracy, if you will, that is the evolutionary process. Things will get advanced, disseminated, whatnot, one way or another. If the only mechanism for spreading something is war, then that's what the evolutionary process will use. Despite all appearances to the contrary, there's something good happening through that vehicle. There's always something good happening through every vehicle. You can trust that. Right? The fact that we don't start with a foundation of trust in all things is why people start to get all frantic and running around with their hair on fire about this, that, and the other thing. It's like, that this is purely bad and has to be eliminated or attacked or whatever. It's like, no, there really is no such thing. Right? The parts can't help but be in a good context. And so when all is said and done, all parts lead to goodness. They can't do anything else. They're constrained thus by the goodness of the frame they exist in.
Yeah. It's interesting to think, well, what made them? They obviously were effective mercenaries, and they also made an impression on people to be able to spread a doctrine. People must have wanted, what makes them such fearless warriors?
Yeah, so I was going to mention that too, because you don't normally think of the Jews as these incredible warriors.
No.
Until you give them a country again, and the Arabs try to wipe them out, and that didn't last long.
Actually, they were quite effective.
Yeah, it was very effective. they're reminding you, that goes way back. It also reminds you when we saw some of those Jewish leaders, like, oh yeah, I'm going to go out and take on the Pharaoh's army or something. I mean, it's not sort of infinite presumption, right? I mean, they are decent warriors. There's limits to everything, But anyway, so you can, yeah, you, there's all kinds of little things that you can think about that's playing in that tiny little paragraph there. You know, it, like I was just saying, you know, when they say in ancient times the Jews were famed as much for military value. Yeah. See, it took a long time, but that finally came back around again. And in the modern world, so-called modern world, in the present world, current world, you know, there's some fame there for their, you know everyone in Israel, you know, has to spend some time in the military, etc. Okay?
The basic doctrines of Greek philosophy, Jewish theology, and Christian ethics were fundamentally repercussions of the earlier Melchizedek teachings.
Yeah, so that's just that little statement is reminding you that you know what I said up front about how various elements that have a common Andite-like cultural aspect to them can come together one way or another. They resonate with one another. Machiaventa was playing upon that foundation, sort of seeding that, fostering that, that Andite common foundation could, in common, pick up on Melchizedek's teachings. And so, on that substrate, if you will, of the Andite cultural foundation, Melchizedek poured out his teachings, and it was on that foundation that it that ministry spread and came together and brought and ended up bringing a lot of separate elements together, like Greek philosophy, Jewish theology, and Christian ethics. You know, maybe you could even say bringing in kind of a Roman sort of a sensibility into play there. Okay, so that's our little predicate. Now let's get into the details of how that basic thumbnail sketch played out, starting with the Greeks here.
Section 1. The Salem religion among the Greeks. The Salem missionaries might have built up a great religious structure among the Greeks had it not been for their strict interpretation of their oath of ordination, a pledge imposed by Machiaventa, which forbade the organization of exclusive congregations for worship, and which exacted the promise of each teacher never to function as a priest, never to receive fees for religious service, only food, clothing, and shelter. When the Melchizedek teachers penetrated to pre-Hellenic Greece, they found a people who still fostered the traditions of Adamson and the days of the Andites. But these teachings had become greatly adulterated with the notions and beliefs of the hordes of inferior slaves that had been brought to the Greek shores in increasing numbers. This adulteration produced a reversion to a crude animism of bloody rites, the lower classes even making ceremonial out of the execution of condemned criminals.
Okay. So let's kind of get more specific about what we're talking about here. So remember, Machiaventa came in 1980 BC. So once you get to past 1900 BC, you can start to imagine something spreading, out into the world. And it's gonna head towards Greece. And when they say pre-Hellenic Greece, this will be more obvious when we get to the next paragraph, if you know anything about ancient Greece. Generalize a little bit. Don't think if you know the term Hellenic, by pre-Hellenic, don't think merely before the 8th century BC. extend it back a ways. Extend it back into Mycenaean Greece. Like I said, as we'll kind of see more directly in the next paragraph. In other words, extend it back, in those first couple hundred years after Machiaventa, as things are spreading out, they're getting into, the Greek, the region that will eventually be Greece, and engaging the peoples there. So like pre, if you will, Hellenic, way back there in the second millennium BC, not in the, not merely in the first millennium BC. Okay, so way back there, you've got a context of people that have been influenced, going back thousands of years. Like they're reminding you there, from Adamson, to the north of Mesopotamia, and things heading westward from there, bringing that Andite culture in, out into the Mediterranean and up into Europe. And we talked about that way back when. Okay, so you had some very deep Andite-like influence there. But it's been very adulterated, as they say there, by the common thing that, that usually causes this problem, bringing in lots of slaves from, non-Andite cultural contexts, and it all getting corrupted and drugged down by material gravity to very primitive estates.
That reminds me of
right. We used to not have false political correctness about this. We used to know that that's what brings the end of basically all civilizations is blending in non-Andite influences because of slaves, and the sex impulse being what it is, right? Yeah, it blends. It doesn't stay pure when you bring in slaves.
There must have been a pretty definite class consciousness, but there were still, they didn't maintain, or they didn't start caste systems like they did in India, but it was still.
Yeah, and you can tell here, way back in those ancient times, it's degraded to the point where you sort of have just one class, a very lowly, primitive class, right? I mean, it's been so debased that you really don't have much of a cream, that's on the surface at all.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in these extremely ancient times. See, back there in the second millennium BC, way before what we think of as ancient Greece, right? Going way back, okay, into the second millennium BC. Like they're trying to point out, it's a very dark, crude place. Even the leaders would be very crude. Okay, so initially those Melchizedek missionaries, unlike when they went into some areas, had they had very little to work with. I mean, how are you going to bring in word about the Most High God, when all they've got is a crude animism with bloody rites? I mean, there's just nothing to work with there. Okay. So, very limited ability for them to do anything there initially, way back there in those first couple hundred years after Machiaventa. But as we're about to see in the next paragraph, the Melchizedek influence is going to get some assistance. We obviously need a genetic boosting, right, to occur here, so that there's a better foundation to work with in this very adulterated, debased genetic context that's there. Let's see, what else do we have there? Oh, the very important thing up front. So, you know, notice that. They might have built a great religious structure among the Greeks had it not been for... Okay, so, they're kind of... They're speaking sort of in general, not just in that specific historical context. But in general there, if they hadn't been so pure about teaching that religion is a purely individual inner life fact, so you notice that's what they're saying there. If they'd gone with the evolutionary religion, which is quote-unquote religion, it's thought of as some fancy outer life ritualistic sort of a thing with priests. If they had compromised that way, like Paul compromised, they would have had a lot more success. You got to go with the people you've got. There's no one alive today that's really ready for a purely inner life religion without priests. Yeah, so 4,000 years ago, okay, even less so. Right, so just notice that the pragmatism of the evolutionary phenomenon that they're reminding of. And they're reminding you, it's not surprising that when all is said and done with Christianity, you had a priest-dominated outer life ritualistic phenomenon. That's what's natural for the people we're talking about. Not some, transcendent inner, life reflective understanding. So they're reminding you of that, we talked about that towards the end last week, as we remember towards the end of this the preceding paper, they were making the same points about how you have to face the facts of where people are religiously. They're very inside out right now still, and you have to start there, and then trust that over long spans of time it will be brought in and uplifted more. If your desire is to somehow really engage and help the main evolutionary stream process. And if that's not your modus operandi, then don't worry about that, right? Just like I've said many times, just let go of all that. Establish a genuine religion purely as an inner life fact within you, independent of any group phenomenon whatsoever. Establish an individual binding back to eternity, and let some real fruits of the Spirit begin to pour out from you in whatever group outer life context you happen to be in. Right? And just entrust those fruits to the evolutionary process to do something useful with them. But if you have some desire, I'll repeat it again, like they're saying here, these Melchizedek missionaries were wanting to affect the evolutionary stream, the main evolutionary stream. Well, you've got to face the facts of that. You can't go in there like they were here with, forbade the organization of exclusive congregations of worship, right? And, the teacher could never function as a priest. they're not going to get anywhere, basically, in that purest mode. It's one thing for somebody to be adulterated relative to eternity. It's another for, another considered adulterated relative to time. Okay? It's... something that, relative to eternity, is very far removed from eternity, may be very appropriate in time for a short span of time, right? Yeah. Existentially, you may call it bad, but as an evolutionary phenomenon for in a specific place at a specific time, it is good. Even though it's, not of eternity. Right? So that, that's what they were missing. It would have been good for them to have approached it in a more evolutionary way instead of in such a purist existential way. And only that would be good, see, in their minds. All right. See, anything else there? The hordes of inferior slaves. Like I said, here comes the political incorrectness. Anything else there? Let's see. The final thing of, when you're in kind of a primitive mode, you still have a desire for entertainment. And, humans have often turned hangings into entertainment, right? Even making ceremonial out of the execution of condemned criminals. I mean, that's not just these poor schmucks way back then, right? I mean, that's a fairly common phenomenon.
Like the gladiators, right?
The gladiators or, there's nothing else to do in the little town out in the dusty west, somewhere. let's take the kids to the hanging today. It's going to be fun. Right, you make a whole big shindig out of it, right? It's an excuse for a party. All of that is just natural in our very basal animal natures. That's just the way we are. Okay. So what they're really telling you there is they're not some evil, perverted people. No, this is nothing but basic animal nature that we all have. That's where the mode they're in.
It's a little bit more than just animal nature to want to have a holiday.
Yeah, right. Obviously, like you're injecting these little scraps of human drive, into the phenomenon. But
I don't think entertainment is the word we want to use. I think something that breaks up the normal day to day boredom or day to day patterns.
Yeah, exactly.
Different.
Right. Yeah.
But I don't think entertainment is the word.
Yeah. I mean, I was using the word entertainment you could say it that way, or just, to mean exactly what you're saying. Something that breaks the monotony, a diversion from the mundane, right? Let's take an aside here. Okay, now back to the drudgery. That sense of entertainment. Okay, let's keep going here.
The early influence of the Salem teachers was nearly destroyed by the so-called Aryan invasion from southern Europe in the east. These Hellenic invaders brought along with them anthropomorphic god concepts similar to those of which their Aryan fellows had carried to India. This importation inaugurated the evolution of the Greek family of gods and goddesses. This new religion was partly based on the cults of the incoming Hellenic barbarians, but it also shared in the myths of the older inhabitants of Greece.
Okay, see, so remember how, you had that, those late, basically Andite invasions into India, the so-called Aryan invasions. Again, at this very late date, you have a similar phenomenon, going westward. Okay, and so this is where you go, oh, I see, like these Hellenic invaders. Okay, so they're using, the word Hellenic, in other words, Greek, kind of literally, in a little bit more generalized sense to include, I'll go all the way back to those Mycenaean Greeks. In other words, when you see the first Indo-European language, right, see that had a very definitively Andite language coming in there. Now, even though you don't have, you know, a current Greek script when you go way back that far. But you've got, it's an Indo-European people, and they're bringing in Zeus and whatnot, like they're saying there, right? Just like we saw in India, where they're bringing that. You know, and we'll get to that here in the next paragraph here with the god concepts.
Why did they call it so-called Aryan invasion?
Oh, just, you know, there were, you know, that's the way thing, you know, back in the time this book was written, you know, that's the term that was used as Aryan. You know, like I just did a second ago, you know, we'll say Indo-European now instead of Aryan. But it's, you know, it's, you know, you can, you know, in adding to it, if you want to use the word Aryan, it's like, okay, you'll use that for that, you know, older phenomenon going into India, you know, but the reason it was, see, some people were considering that to be an Aryan invasion into, you know, into the West there, is because of its commonality with, you know, if language-wise, if nothing else, with what was, you know, going to the East, into India, right? Yeah.
It's interesting that they may have been racially superior, but they call them barbarians.
Yeah.
So was Greece at that time more civilized, relatively speaking, relative to the incoming barbarians?
No. Like we were just pointing out, not at all.
No.
We haven't gotten to, you know, the 8th century and that's and subsequent stuff yet. Right, so it's still, you know, relatively barbaric, and you know, and it is, but it is a genetic booster shot. Right, bringing in some more Andite descended blood, not literally Andite blood, but you know, more Andite like blood. So it's positive in that sense. But notice, despite the primitiveness of what the Melchizedek missionaries were working with to begin with, they were slowly over time, over the many decades, getting things together a little bit, and then in comes this totally new phenomenon and blew all that up. And so it kind of had to start all over again. See, the early influence of the Salem teachers was nearly destroyed by this sort of these better genetic people coming in. You know, you had similar things in Mesopotamia. You know, you can bring in some more barbarian sorts of people that smash through the doors of the relatively civilized stuff there in Mesopotamia, but then over time they become a little bit more civilized. You know, they've come from they've got the genetics to be more civilized, but they've been living in very uncivilized, you know, domains and haven't been challenged to really actualize their genetic potentials to be more civilized. Okay, see, so that's what's going on there. So when they mention there at the end how you've got what they're bringing in, these invaders, and then that mixes in with what was there before. And in that early language, you literally see that. It's got elements that are related to, you know, kind of classical Greek, plus elements that are of the more ancient stuff, sort of the pre-writing stuff. In that early written stuff, you know, the written language is a combination of what comes to be kind of classical Greek, and then that older stuff, just like saying. So not only is the culture blending like they're saying there, but you can literally see that in the language that you can dig up and figure out how to read. All right. You know, and like I said, in this next paragraph, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna get to the specific issues. Just like we saw when the Melchizedek missionaries went into India, these anthropomorphic God concepts were already in place there, remember? And we talked about how the Melchizedek missionaries might work with that stuff. But see, they got to Greece, quote unquote, right, before that stuff had gotten there. And so those ideas are just coming in now. So let's see what they say about that. Oh, I should tell you that, I mean, in other words, we're talking about starting about 1700 BC. You have that invasion? See, so like I said, a couple hundred years that the Melchizedek missionaries would have been there before, right, before this complication enters in. But also a new potential enters in. Okay, so now we're going forward from like 1700 BC, heading towards what is kind of more precisely going to be called Hellenic, starting in the 8th century BC.
The Hellenic Greeks found the Mediterranean world largely dominated by the mother cult, and they imposed upon these peoples their man-god, Deus Zeus, who had already become, like Yahweh, among the henotheistic Semites, head of the whole Greek pantheon of subordinate gods. And the Greeks would have eventually achieved a true monotheism in the concept of Zeus, except for their retention of the overcontrol of fate. A god of final value must himself be the arbiter of fate and the creator of destiny.
Okay, we'll get to the deeper elements at the end there in a second. Let's just start with these basic issues about God concepts. So, remember you have predicated off of Cain leaving the second garden, right? And since his only quote-unquote divine parent, as the common people saw it, was Eve, right? You ended up with not a dual kind of God concept coming from that Cain influence, but the mother cult, right? That's been going, so it's coming down all the way from Adam and Eve's time, right? Is that mother cult, you know, predicated just on Eve instead of on Adam and Eve. And it's infiltrated, all around the Mediterranean area and stuff. And those immediate environs. So you've got that whole mother cult. Obviously this far removed from Eve, it's going to be quite primitive, right? It's going to have all kinds of fixations on fertility and the exaltation of sex and what have you, of course, you know. But it's that mother cult, the same cult that didn't go away all the way until Jesus's time, right? And fed into the Catholic Church with the exaltation of Mary, right? So that you could absorb the mother cult into Christianity. Okay, so that's the environment, and so you've got a mother, if you will, biased ghost cult notion, and they're going to bring in a father notion, right? This more andite-like thing. So just like, remember those earliest days in India, you had Deus Pitar. See how they use the Deus again, right? Remember Deus Pitar, there in India, that means literally sky father. Deus Pitar, sky father. Deus is sky. Zeus is the same word, that's sky too, right, as Deus. Yeah, they're calling him Deus Zeus there just to remind you that this is the same sky god notion, right? One went to the east, the other, went to the West. It's the same Andite predicated sky god, but more than just sky god. You don't just call him Deus. You don't just call him Zeus, all right? You call him Deus Pater. You call him Zeus Pater. Sky father, Zeus Pater. Right? Sky father. Zeus is sky. Okay. So it's the same sky father. And just like we talked about, you know, the potential there in India for those Melchizedek missionaries is like, well, okay, you know, to get to the Most High God, you have to lift your eyes up out of the plane with a bunch of very crude, sort of in the plane of mankind, quote-unquote, gods or spirits, right, to something that's elevated in concept. Now, the Sky Father is an obvious one that you could play off of and improve the concept of. Right, so you've got that here. And just as we saw before, see, and the Greeks would have eventually achieved a true monotheism starting with the Sky Father and improving it, just, you know, essentially no different than the Hebrews started with the volcano god and improved it, you know, into the universal father. Right, you could have improved this into the universal father too, in some ways more directly, right? You didn't have to start, you know, with the volcano and, you know, get up to the sky. At least, you know, you start with the sky. But what was the issue here? Remember, there was issues in India that messed it all up. What's the issue here? You've got this over control of fate concept. It's very, very definitive. What does that mean? You know, in other words, you're short circuiting any budding recognition of free will. In other words, of personality. In other words, of a genuinely personal universal father. Right, who, you know, it's in, like, for instance, it's not in the hands of fate, you know, where you're headed. It's in your free will hands. Right? You have to know that you have free will. And ultimately that, not any vicissitudes that you might exalt and call fate, right, are in control of your destiny. Not to mention, right, if there isn't free will and personality, there can't, you know, not only don't you really have destiny in your hands, there can't be a creator of destiny, like they're saying there. I see. So so you know, we saw the personality, the budding personality recognition short-circuited in India for various reasons. Here we're seeing it short-circuited yet again.
So a person's concept of God either limits his own self.
Yeah, sense of self, right?
Sense of self.
Yeah.
Or gives it space to grow.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Like we've said many times, I mean, you know, one of the reasons that you can right up front understand for the Urantia book, going into vast, you know, reaches of challenging you to think about, you know, things all the way up to the Trinity, infinite, and, you know, things like this. You know, well, it's like, well, what's the point? Well, I mean, if nothing else, it's, you know, if you push yourself to those lengths, to some degree, you're eliminating any potential to short circuit your progress, right? You're eliminating all ceilings, all boundaries, all unfortunate self-limitations for your growth. Right? You're giving space for unlimited growth. You know, you're supplying a favorable condition of not cramming yourself in a thimble and wondering why you're not growing much.
Hi, Chris.
Yep.
One has to limit oneself because there's a hierarchy to acknowledge and know that
we are small in comparison.
Right. You limit yourself in a kind of a more immediate sense, but in that sort of upfront, just basic conceptualization, you know, throw all the doors open, right? Let yourself be in an infinite space, and then now, find an appropriate peace in an initial limited domain within that infinite space, right? You don't have to try to adapt yourself to the super universe first, right? You can adapt yourself to the local universe first, right? Right. I mean, that's appropriate, right? You have to limit yourself sort of, practically, okay, but don't limit your ideals. I mean, say it that way. Don't limit your ideals. Let them exist in infinity. But limit your ideas, right? Like, okay, this needs to be a local universe idea because I'm getting way ahead of myself if I try to construct a super universe idea, right? Yeah.
Why is it capitalized fate?
Oh, because, right.
Because
it basically takes the personality away from you and becomes personalized. It's capital F fate, you know. It's the will that's in control and not you, right? It gets personified and hence capitalized. See, that's what I was saying. I mean, you've surrendered your personality to this concept called faith, and hence capitalized the F.
Well, that's convenient. Then you don't have to have any personal responsibility.
Right. How can you? You have no personality. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. this book that was written by an Arab author describing growing up in Egypt. It was a common saying, as God wills.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Inshallah.
You weren't truly in charge of your life.
Yes.
You did the best you could, but whatever happened, it was because God wills it.
God wills it. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. See, and that's they still use that to today. I mean, it's always been that. It's an easy out for the indolent. You know, it's like, well, I mean, seriously, I mean, it's in God's hands, not mine. I mean, I'm just a helpless victim of antecedent causation. So whether it's capital F fate, you know, or surrendering everything to some, you know, unfortunate God concept, you know, which just starts to be kind of God the infinite instead of God the Father, or whatever it is. Right? That's the colossal error of capital P pantheism, right? I mean, again, see, capital P pantheism, not lowercase p pantheism. See, you know, you're surrendering your free will and putting yourself as just a helpless victim to some greater will, whatever you call it. That's an unfortunate choice to make. Yeah, so, like they're saying, a God of final value must, you know, himself, etc. See, another thing you can think of there, the reason why you need a God like that is because only a God like that could give you what you need. Right? The personality that you need to be in possession of so that you can have a domain of sovereignty unto yourself. Otherwise, it's all just an illusion. You're just a drop of water in an ocean and not really an individual. Right? You know, it's just a game. You're pretending you're an individual. Right? And if you're just pretending, it's like, well, what's the point then? And if I cease to be a little kid that can live by pretending, I grow up and I accept the fact that I really have no absolute individuality, you know, even in potential, you know, you end up in a very nihilistic so-called adult state. Nothing is really in your hands, and what's the point? we just have this, the same, what's going to become the Greek pantheon. It's it's starting with that same Indo-European common God concept that is, you know, it may not have way back started henotheistic, but, you know, as they're pointing out, it doesn't take long, and it becomes a henotheism, not a polytheism, you know. The Sky Father is above the others, right? All the ones that are dealing with things down on Earth, right? I mean, it's just sort of, well, the sky is above the Earth. So, I mean, it just naturally produces, you know, a henotheism, you know, when you've got a Sky Father. Okay.
As a consequence of these factors in religious evolution, there presently developed the popular belief in the happy-go-lucky gods of Mount Olympus. Gods more human than divine, and gods which the intelligent Greeks never did regard very seriously. They neither greatly loved nor greatly feared these divinities of their own creation. They had a patriotic and racial feeling for Zeus and his family of half-men and half-gods, but they hardly reverenced or worshipped them.
So, you know, this is kind of, you know, sending you forward. By the time you get to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, right, you know, you're in a state of affairs where there isn't sort of any definitive upfront religion, you know, that you can bring into play with these very sophisticated philosophic reflections that you're developing. Happy-go-lucky, you know, I mean, you know, you can barely call them gods. You know, I mean, they're so, you know, like they're saying there. They're more human than divine. Yeah, they're magic humans, right? Not really gods at all. Eventually. So, and again, that's all just what we saw earlier. There's this strong tendency for material gravity of this area of the world to drag things down. In the hands of the little bit more andite motivated like people, you know, there's this budding tendency for spiritual gravity to start to lift one god up out of the other gods and move towards monotheism, but you bring in a more material gravity setting, not to mention slaves or whatnot, and it's just going to drag things all back down into the plane again. And the only way that you envision them as being exalted is not so much in concept, but just literally in elevation. They're standing on ground that they're on a mountaintop. They're, you know, literally just elevation-wise higher ground than where you're standing, and so they're elevated in your mind. I mean, they're not really that conceptually elevated, right? They're just vertically, spatially elevated. I mean, see, it's that simplistic. Right? You know, it's like Orange Man piling up rocks, you know, and thinking he's, you know, building exaltation. Okay, so that's the state of affairs. This is not, you know, it's all kind of a joke, you know, the whole Mount Olympus Greek pantheon thing to these, you know, quickly quite sophisticated 6th century BC forward reflective thinkers. Let's see. And remember, you know, quickly you bring in Zeus playing around with all sorts of human females so that you literally get half men, half gods, you know, demigods. Just that too. See, it's just all the more lowering it down. Okay.
The Hellenes became so impregnated with the anti-priestcraft doctrines of the earlier Salem teachers that no priesthood of any importance ever arose in Greece. Even the making of images to the gods became more of a work in art than a matter of worship.
Okay, see, so isn't that interesting to appreciate how it is that the Greeks, one of the reasons why when you had this the spiritual quickening of the 6th century BC, one of the reasons why in Greece it didn't manifest so sort of directly religiously like we saw it do in India or China or what have you, is because of those missionaries so definitively making an impression upon the people there in an anti-priestcraft way. You know, and so again, like I said, I mean, it's like, okay, priests, we know they give you all kinds of problems, like the Hebrews, you know, they were sorts of endless problems for the Hebrews, you know, dragging their religion down into the mud. But they're sort of an indispensable stepping stone, like we saw way back when we went through the evolution of religion, you know, that you can only get to higher heights by establishing priests and standing on the heads of those priests to get to reach things higher up. You know, you use them as a stepladder when all is said and done. And if you don't have that stepladder, you just can't reach what's on the top shelf, you know, in general. So, isn't it interesting that that's one of the reasons why philosophy ended up manifesting so definitively out of the Greeks rather than religion? So you can bring it all the way full circle. Well, thank goodness that they really fixated on those, you know, what those Melchizedek missionaries said, because what if no one on the planet had gotten a philosophic quickening from the spiritual quickening of the 6th century BC? Where would this planet be right now if we didn't have the ancient Greeks to, you know, give Western civilization some context? Wow, that's something to think about. You know, we would be in a pretty sad state of affairs if there hadn't been people like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. So, yeah. See, so when all is said and done, right, is there any coincidences actually? Right? It all very cleverly works, you know, as it needs to. There needs to be a people that really don't have a priestcraft so that they can, So, the fact that all the balls were dropped with the first two epical revelations, right? The evolutionary process is going to be very clever in finding ways to make up for all those things that they would have done very directly. Right? The evolutionary process is going to find a way to do it indirectly. Coincidentally, there's going to be this, that, and the other element. All the elements that would have been very, you know, directly given, say, by the prince's staff, you know, they're going to find a way to come into existence through an evolutionary, circuitous, curious evolutionary process. Can't happen any other way. Because, you know, the end is driven by the frame in which all the parts exist. They can't do anything but end up where they need to end up when all is said and done. There's only one overarching force behind it all, right? And it's perfectly holistic and good.
So John has a comment. Something to the effect of the Andites having a significant drop in spirituality around 6500 BC owing to the amalgamation with the Blue Man.
You could go back and, you know, obviously when we bring this stuff up, it might get you curious again to go back and read some of those Andite migration stories and kind of remind yourself how this plays out, you know, and, you know, things that you can see there are similar to what I was just talking about where, you see the evolutionary process making use of the super additive potentials of bringing in another race. Now, maybe something that's kind of, you know, relatively pure Andite, but it's getting degraded by whatever issues. You bring in another race, it gives it a super additive booster shot. All those things that, you know, remember, you have all those races, and it was supposed to be all managed by Adam and Eve, where they're, okay, we're going to bring these two together, and that's going to give this booster shot. You know, they would have coordinated, managed all that in a very, you know, so it would all come to pass in a very linear, if you will, short span of time. Yeah. Okay, you throw that out, that management like that, well, the evolutionary process has got to do, when all said and done, the same thing. But it's going to be a very circuitous, complicated process that, you know, eventually brings the elements together. And there'll be lots of unfortunate tangential dead ends that it will produce, and, you know, just like we saw with the biologic evolutionary process. But when all was said and done, no matter how many weird dead end tangents that, you know, biologically there was on this planet, you got the Andonites. Right. It didn't happen in a couple years. It took a long time, right? But yeah, it comes out in the end, right? Because the whole thing has an overarching, you know, forcing influence on it. You know, to that end, right? It can't end up anywhere else. Like I was just saying a minute ago, the means to the end vary, but the end varies not.
Right? Yeah. You've got a squirrely looking path on a lightning bolt, but you still completed the circuit.
Right. Right. One way or another, it gets to the ground. Right.
And that leads to light and life.
Yeah. Eventually the planet will get to light and life. It's gonna be, you know, it's gonna be a very relatively unique, you know, curious path for this planet, but you know. It can't get anywhere else. Right? I mean, it's just like, you know, where are you going to end up? On the Isle of Paradise, you know, at the end of your ascension career? Right? There's no other place you can end up. Right? The paths there are, you know, are completely, you know, beyond our comprehension and diversity, right? The means to that end, but the end is the end, right? When all is said and done, every one ascender becomes a finaliter on the Isle of Paradise. Yeah, there isn't some alternative destiny to the ascension scheme, right? So, you know, it's a given you will get there. The only way to not get there is to not be. Right? But if you are, you will end up there, right? Okay, that's you know, that's just the way the system works, because the parts are all in a frame, and the frame defines you know, the destiny of the parts. Okay, maybe just a little comment there. So, you know, your free will, you know, and your participation in your destiny. See, if you're going to be part of that destiny, you know, you don't need to choose yourself. You need to choose the frame. If you choose the frame, your destiny is assured. Right? Because the destiny is inherent in the frame.
What's the distinction between the frame you're speaking of and fate? They're both kind of an over-control phenomenon. One is true, and the other apparently is false.
Right. See, that's why fate was initially imagined and continued on forever, even to today. I mean, it has a measure of truth in it. Right? See? It's just, if you think that all the only personal, you know, will is in the frame and not in the parts, that's the problem. Right? You know, I mean, another reason why it's kind of complicated to bring in God the Mother, God, personalized deity, the Mother, personalizing the frame, it's like, well, wait a minute, isn't that just another name for capital F fate? Right? See, I mean, you know, you have to for them to be telling this and us about God the Mother and things like that in the fifth epical revelation, that requires some sophistication on your part, so you don't just get sucked into the old mode of, oh, right, it's all in her hands, not mine. It's like, no. See, you know, in other words, another way to look at this is don't do what Jesus did as a creator being and say, not my will, but yours be done, you know, which is basically saying, well, I don't have a will, really. You know, I just have to submit to the will of the frame. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, what you do as a creature is, it is my will that your will be done, right? You're active, not passive. You know, like I said, you're choosing the frame. You know, just like the Universal Father chose the frame, put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. But you have free will. You know, you choose to participate in the system. You aren't just a helpless victim, you know, a non-free will victim of some willed system, capital F fate, right? Yeah. And be careful to not turn the God the Mother concept in your mind into that. I mean, it's actually helpful, you know, in general to just talk about the Mother and kind of, you know, not bring in the personality too early on in your thinking so that you don't end up kind of just, you know, end up being, oh, I'm just subject to her will. I mean, what else am I going to do? Right? You know, I don't really have any free will, do I? see, it's a tricky balance that you've got to strike.
It seems like she gives you potential. She doesn't take away. She gives you potential.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the potential that's served up to you that you have. Then you have the opportunity to make a choice to do something with it or not.
Yeah.
And you have to own that.
Yeah. And sure, initially, there's, you know, not a lot of originality on your part. You're having to just kind of get synced up with the, you know, the context that you're in. But eventually, there will be a place for your originality. You'll contribute something she can't, or he can't, or no one else can, right? I mean, you know, but it's, see, that liberty of yours, originality, that liberty is in law, right? And but before you can really exercise that liberty, you have to get in law, right? Just don't, you know, think that, you know, that's all there is that sort of capital F law or capital F fate or something, right? You know, you know, and you don't really have any say. I mean, think about how, you know, most of your local universe career, they tell you in paper 117, is really kind of just getting coordinated with the framework, you know, and then you leave the local universe and then you can start to really kind of add some of your originality to in that context. But until you can really be properly coordinated with the framework, you know, there's really no place for your imaginings of originality, right? Yeah. Yeah. Or like if you don't have perfection of purpose, they don't even let you in the door of Avona because you have to be absolutely spot on, every I, every T, you know, dotted and crossed just so, right? I mean, it's this rigorous environment, you know, completely rigid. But within it, you know, you find this incredible liberty of will that you couldn't have anywhere else, right? And you're able to do that by the time you get there. See, so it's just stages of a general process of this.
We can recognize that same principle here now, just like a civilized country. If you live in a civilization, if you're civilized, you're putting yourself subordinate to the laws.
Yeah.
But it leaves you free to do pretty much whatever you wish within that framework. But if you live in a savage environment, you're not more free.
No.
You're completely subject to everything.
Yeah, right. You have no opportunity for genuine liberty.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a similar thing as we move up.
Yeah.
The more we become law-abiding, the more free we truly become.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, to not know that is to get sucked into the sophistries of the Lucifer Rebellion, right? He was the one that was preaching otherwise to what I've just been talking about. Say, oh, no, there is no frame you have to coordinate to. No, yeah. That's the sophistries of the Lucifer Rebellion, to think otherwise, to think you just have liberty, not liberty in law.
And if you did just have liberty, you wouldn't have an ordered boundary condition. So how do you have liberty?
Right. Yeah. Right. Like Gene was just pointing out, right? It's if you really reflect on it, you quickly bring it back around and see that it's impossible to have liberty out without law.
Suppose he kind of ran into that point of
recognition. Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, you know, it eventually came back around. I was like, oh, wait a minute. Liberty is impossible without a framework. Right, there would be absolute chaos and hence no liberty, right, otherwise. But he'd already gone public and didn't have the courage to say, oh, never mind. Should have reflected a little bit more before I spoke up.
There was a quote of the day recently where they defined true liberty as with as the ability to love and be loved and to serve your fellows, which I thought was pretty cool because it doesn't, I mean, everything else, you sort of need to be able to take it or leave it. It's like you're getting the freedom to have the best experience there is in the universe. And that's all, I mean, everything else is kind of neither here nor there.
Right. The only reason you exist is to establish true relationship. And so the only way that's possible is that when all the other stuff is taken care of, so you can focus solely on the one thing that you can really add, it wasn't there in the concept of the I am.
Yeah.
Right. That true relationship. And all the mechanics, have to be in place. Right? And, if you have to deal with all the mechanics, you can't get to the pure relationship. It's like being a two-brainer instead of a three-brainer. Because I'm not a three-brainer, my left hemisphere has to deal with lots of things that for a three-brainer, those very basal things, the basic mechanics of life, are taken care of by that third brain. One of my hemispheres has to deal with all that stuff, which means it's not free to really fully engage the unity side and get the full super additive consequence. That it's the same thing there. That when all is said and done, you need to be free from having to deal with all the mechanics. That's just all in place, and you can focus on the real job task at hand. Yeah. The conduit is there. You've perfectly synchronized with the conduit, so you don't have to do anything there, and you can just focus on what goes through that conduit, that true relationship. Okay. The fact that you're synchronized with the conduit, that's what makes the relationship true.
When people are repersonalized on the mansion worlds, so three-brainers, two-brainers, one-brainers, they must all be repersonalized as similar creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I mean, again, there's all those differences because the evolution of the Supreme, requires all this complexity and whatnot, you know. But it's but the point is to eventually transcend those limitations. And some people start with more limitations than others.
To he who's been given much.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Where were we here? We did the next to the last paragraph, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see, anything else there? I think we got everything there. Yeah, let's get the last one there.
The Olympian gods illustrate man's typical anthropomorphism. But the Greek mythology was more aesthetic than ethic. The Greek religion was helpful in that it portrayed a universe governed by a deity group. But Greek morals, ethics, and philosophy presently advanced far beyond the god concept. And this imbalance between intellectual and spiritual growth was as hazardous to Greece as it had proved to be in India.
Okay. Yeah, so like we were talking before, there's going to be this tendency to for the focusing of personality, you know, in that monotheistic God concept to fuse out, you know, into some, you know, pantheism sort of thing, you know, at best, or, you know, whatever, you know, just to have it all fuzzed out into the Brahman, you know, or whatever. So, yeah, they're reminding you that, you know, you need that nucleus to keep things from fuzzing out, right? You know, that religious nucleus keeps it focused and prevents it from diffusing into some mist, right?
Well, it sounds like they became personally very moral, ethical, and philosophical, but their gods were kind of unethical,
yes,
immoral.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Sort of like intellectually top heavy, kind of different from India's imbalance, but equally problematic.
Yeah. It just, you know, like we pointed out, I mean, not having such a religious, you know, element, it allowed for some things to develop, you know, that couldn't develop in other places. But all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? See, so I was just pointing that out. You know, no matter what setting it is, you know, you've got some good element, but it's not the whole picture. And so in that culture, it eventually is going to be, you're going to go beyond that threshold where it's a net negative. To not have the rest of the picture in play. So those groups, they need to bring their part to full flower, and then they need to combine and bring all the parts together, right? As soon as their part is ripe. And normally, you know, Adam and Eve and whatnot would manage all of that sort of stuff, right? But we don't have that. So.
Like, wasn't that supposed to give rise to the philosopher kings? That way that was
literally setting up, you know, a group of beings that would very definitively oversee those sorts of bringing the concepts together into a super summative, you know. Picture, philosophic picture, yeah. All right, but what about this, you know, the philosophic thought here? Because like we were saying before, they did very importantly contribute that to the picture in the 6th century BC and forward from there.
2, Greek philosophic thought. A lightly regarded and superficial religion cannot endure, especially when it has no priesthood to foster its forms, to fill the hearts of the devotees with fear and awe. The Olympian religion did not promise salvation, nor did it quench the spiritual thirst of its believers. Therefore, was it doomed to perish. Within a millennium of its inception, it had nearly vanished, and the Greeks were without a national religion, the gods of Olympus having lost their hold upon the better minds.
Yeah, see, so right there you can see when they say within the millennium, I told you, so you had that Indo-European, you know, that Andite-related invasion coming in, say, at about 1700 B.C. Within a millennium, you get to the 8th century B.C., you know, when it really kind of begins more technically Hellenic times. And, right, and you've got what they're saying there for, you know, from the Olympian god concept, you know, nothing of any tangible significance. So, as you set the stage for the spiritual quickening in the 6th century B.C., you know, in the 8th and 7th centuries preceding it, you know, you don't have much for a, an overt religion element that spiritual quickening can play off of, can catalyze. And it's, yeah. So if it doesn't work with the nucleus in the individuals, it's going to work with the sphere surrounding the nucleus, and it's going to quicken the philosophic recognition rather than the nuclear religious recognition. Because, your encirclement in the Holy Spirit is giving you that spherical frame. Right? And so that's going to get quickened.
This was the situation when, during the 6th century before Christ, the Orient and the Levant experienced a revival of spiritual consciousness and a new awakening to the recognition of monotheism. But the West did not share in this new development. Neither Europe nor Northern Africa extensively participated in this religious renaissance. The Greeks, however, did engage in a magnificent intellectual development.
Advancement. One of those words.
My eyes were wandering over the page there.
Testing us there, Gene.
The Greeks, however, did engage in a magnificent intellectual advancement. They had begun to master fear and no longer sought religion as an antidote therefore. But they did not perceive that true religion is the cure for soul hunger, spiritual disquiet, and moral despair. They sought for the solace of the soul in deep thinking, philosophy, and metaphysics. They turned from the contemplation of self-preservation, salvation, to self-realization and self-understanding.
Self-understanding. Know thyself, right? So there it is. Just kind of said, full flower and eloquently what I was saying before. You've got an awakening, but it's not going to be, on that religious nucleus. And just, the fact that you threw in development instead of advancement, it just highlighted a word I was going to highlight. You know, notice what they said there. That they used the word advancement, okay? Not just progress, but advancement, right? And it was. I mean, by the time you get to Aristotle, he's having some pretty deep recognitions about the nature of mind and some things, mm-hmm. right? So transcendent, in some ways that no one has ever understood them. And I mean, it's only with the fifth epical revelation, when you begin to unpack it, that you begin to recognize exactly what he was talking about. It's like, oh, yeah, see, he got it. So, I mean, it was, some pretty advanced stuff, without a doubt. Not just progressive stuff. And look at how important the thing was there. They had begun to master fear. Okay, so maybe they're not getting to that through the religious front door, but they're backing into it. How many religionists you know, we're mastering fear. You know, even in the quickening of the 6th century BC. Yeah, that's the problem, see? You know, when we saw that, really, you know, evolutionary religion starts with fear. Yeah, so yeah, you can quicken religion, but you still have that evolutionary fear thing right in front of your face. And if you turn away from that, you know, maybe you can... Maybe you can back into this goal that Jesus told us to seek and fear not. So yeah, see, there's positives and negatives to all these, you know, these differences we see here.
And, you know, they point out just above, paragraph above, about the absence of fear and awe.
Mm-hmm.
What would have otherwise been in place with a strong priesthood.
Yep.
Then it wouldn't have been so mastered, but.
Yeah.
It would have been more symmetric.
Yeah. See, so the Hebrews, you know, couldn't help a lot with what Jesus was saying because since they had such a fear and awe sort of, you know, concept. But you bring in the Greeks into Christianity, and that can actually help you to get to the fear not thing that Jesus was talking about.
Yeah.
So, yes, it can, oh, this can all work together. If you could just bring this together and not let it get all drugged down.
How should we coordinate?
But if you could just tell everyone, you know, what to snip off as we bring it together.
See those
prunings. You know. Saying philosophy and metaphysics. You know, now, of course, that's not true metaphysics. You can only get that with the fifth epical revelation. But you know, see, they were already recognizing that, you know, basically that there's two hemispheres to the sphere of philosophy. And, you know, they wanted the whole sphere, you know, not just the lower hemisphere. But, you know, without the fifth epical revelation, all you can do is attempt, right, to come up with that. All right. Anything else there?
Hold everything conditionally.
Yeah. Which, you know, is, you know, it's so liberating to finally be able to not hold on to it conditionally, but to just firmly plant your feet on it. That's what the authoritative elimination of error, you know, is the fifth epical revelation. It's just so incredibly liberating. It's like, okay, period on that. Now let's move forward. Yeah. No one has ever been able to put a period on things for, you know, 2,600 years, you know, starting from the 6th century. Some of those basic metaphysics, foundational elements. Okay?
By rigorous thought, the Greeks attempted to attain that consciousness of security which would serve as a substitute for the belief in survival. But they utterly failed. Only the more intelligent among the higher classes of the Hellenic peoples could grasp this new teaching. The rank and file of the progeny of the slaves of former generations had no capacity for the reception of this new substitute for religion.
So you again, notice, like I said, you know, what's getting fired up is that, you know, what we're visualizing is the spherical frame that the Holy Spirit encirclement gives you. You know, that philosophic frame, you know, that has a capacity, right? And so they bring in that term, right? They had no capacity. If you can't take delight in cultivating and having that initial minuscule capacity expanded a little bit, you know, you can't find any solace in this, you know, space. How big a sphere does it require to encompass a religious point? Doesn't have to be a very big radius sphere, see? Right? That's why the, you know, even the most primitive person can start with a tiny little thimble space, thimble-sized sphere around a religious point. At least they've got an encompassment of that religious point. Can't fit much else in there besides the point, but okay.
didn't miss the point.
That you didn't miss the point. Yes. Right. Yeah, and especially if you start to try to construct a sphere around where the point isn't potentially, right? You know, then you're getting false philosophies, way off on a tangent.
I've got this sphere. Anybody seen the point that it's supposed to be
surrounded? Oh, I think I should put myself at the center of this sphere. Yeah, right.
Okay, it needs
a center point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what happens. right.
The philosophers disdained all forms of worship, notwithstanding that they practically all held loosely to the background of a belief in the Salem doctrine of, quote, the intelligence of the universe, unquote, the idea of God, and the great source. Insofar as the Greek philosophers gave recognition to the divine and the superfinite, they were frankly monotheistic. They gave scant recognition to the whole galaxy of Olympian gods and goddesses.
So they're reminding you there, since technically you can't get to philosophy if you don't have some basic science-like element and some basic religious element that you can put together in a super additive consequence. I mean, there has to be some basic essence of religion, in the back of their minds anyway. And they're pointing out that those philosophers, they had that coming from, coming down from Machiaventa. The intelligence of the universe, capital I, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of God, the great source. I mean, just a basic sort of the basic philosophic essence, if you will, of a God concept, right? Was there, kind of motivating the philosophic endeavor. But it was just sort of just, there at the very beginning and kind of out of sight, out of mind, going forward. So you were sort of just developing a philosophic picture based upon that little kind of child of God, if you will, starting point. But boy, did they take it to as far as you can take it. See, I mean, like I said, by the time you get to Aristotle, it's like, wow, that's getting a lot out of a tiny, mustard seed of a beginning there. Right? We've talked about that. Spirit is powerful. Just a tiny little bit goes a long way, as the Greeks demonstrated over those three centuries, 654, centuries B.C. And then the fifth epical revelation is trying to say, oh, but you have no idea how much further you can take it if you, start with, prime the pump better to start with.
Right. The Greek poets of the 5th and 6th centuries, notably Pindar, attempted the reformation of Greek religion. They elevated its ideals, but they were more artists than religionists. They failed to develop a technique for fostering and conserving supreme values.
Yeah, see, that whole conserving, especially, like when you think about the religious guardians, the Master Seraphim, the religious guardians. You're going to have long-term problems if you don't have, as we progress forward here, we got to make sure we don't let go of the things that need to be brought forward as foundational elements. Right? Not everything is just a stepping stone. Some things are foundational elements, and you have to bring those forward with you. Right? That's just the writings on the wall. See, long term, mm-hmm. Right? It's going to be an incredible flash, but it's eventually not going to be standing on anything. It's all going to collapse.
Xenophanes taught one God, but his deity concept was too pantheistic to be a personal father to mortal man. Anaxagoras was a mechanist, except that he did recognize a first cause, an initial mind. Socrates and his successors, Plato and Aristotle, taught that virtue is knowledge, goodness, health of the soul, that it is better to suffer injustice than to be guilty of it, that it is wrong to return evil for evil, and that the gods are wise and good. Their cardinal virtues were wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice.
Okay, see, so, you know, like they pointed out, I was saying, you know, that there's this basic little essence of a God concept. So, you know, you may be a mechanist, but you're actually kind of thinking first cause with a capital F and a capital C, not just lowercase letters, see? Mm-hmm. Right, so it's got that little bit of capitalizing like that. You know, initial mind, capital I, capital N, M, etc. But it's just so, it's so tiny, it's not going to, you know, eventually you're going to run out of gas here. But, you know, we all kind of know, you know, how important some of these things were. You know, virtue was a big issue, like they're pointing out. And, you know, some of the things that came back around and fueled the Enlightenment, the three centuries of the Enlightenment, of course. You know, really important getting... you know, getting the greater scientific element developed, you know, that they couldn't way back when. They could kind of just start and imagine, right, but couldn't really bring to fruition. You know, things like the cardinal virtues, wisdom, courage, temperance, and justice. You might notice that instead of saying prudence, fortitude, temperance, and justice. You know, they say wisdom, courage, or temperance, and justice. You know, they in the Revelation here, they give you the more fundamental element. I mean, wisdom, you know, in contrast to a little more complicated prudence, wise judgment. I see you're bringing in a complexity there. You know, and just basic courage in contrast to... you know, going beyond that to patient courage, fortitude. And so they do little things like that, you know, tweak it just to help you with the, to get the physics of this stuff, yeah, you know, clarified a little bit better. And so, you know, you've heard me kind of talk about that stuff over the years. There you can kind of see them bringing in some of those issues. You know, and as we all know, I mean, you know, it's simple, but you know, if you really take a firm hold on those basic elements there, you're going to have a better civilization. Yeah. Right? You can get all the way to the United States.
Yeah.
Throw in a little Jesus.
Yeah. Under God.
Right? Yeah. So, it's very, very important to give the basic framework for a better civilization here, what they're contributing.
You know, back, well, before true, the beginning of some true science, what they taught basically through all that time, or if they didn't lose it entirely or rediscovered it, was what Aristotle said, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't have any science of their own. They just remembered what Aristotle said and passed
right.
that on.
Right. Yeah, and it wasn't until you got to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, you know, that you started to push beyond Aristotle. Yep.
The evolution of religious philosophy among the Hellenic and Hebrew peoples affords a contrastive illustration of the function of the church as an institution in the shaping of cultural progress. In Palestine, human thought was so priest-controlled and scripture-directed that philosophy and aesthetics were entirely submerged in religion and morality. In Greece, the almost complete absence of priests and sacred scriptures left the human mind free and unfettered, resulting in a startling development in depth of thought. But religion as a personal experience failed to keep pace with the intellectual probings into the nature and reality of the cosmos.
Yeah, remember how they talked before about how the Jews had the goodness part, but not so much the truth and beauty parts. Right? They didn't have the philosophy and the aesthetics, right? But they had the morality thing. Or at least, they were attempting to get to the morality thing. So again, we see, it's like we've been talking. It's just fascinating to think about, how the evolutionary process works, what you can get if you take away something. It's like, but if you take that away, eventually that's going to come around and be a problem. It's obvious here, see, that, to kind of think of Christianity in a new light, that despite all of its warts, some of the ghost cult, issues and whatnot that are incorporated into it, it was the setting for bringing together, or at least trying to bring together the best of some of these elements that... parts that had been brought to full flower and amongst certain peoples, but were missing the rest of the parts, and it's why they say the things that they do about Christianity. If you could snip off all of the unfortunate elements and just kind of get to the core essence of these, bringing these things together and work with the super summative consequences of those basic essences, liberated from their bondage and all the ghost cult gibberish and whatnot, superstition and fear and what have you. There's a lot of potential there.
Even today, there's a tendency of better minds to try to distance themselves from religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the exception for a person to hold fast to his religion and still give,
mm-hmm.
Still allow his mind to expand.
Yeah, and you can see, we're kind of being reminded, it's not just because they look at so-called religion and find it to be primitive and superstitious and whatnot and reject it. Some of it is just kind of the tradition of, I want to liberate my mind like the Greeks did and achieve like they did. And it appears that they did that by throwing out religion. See, uh-huh. So some of it is just kind of parroting, the old ones, and doing that.
In Greece, believing was subordinated to thinking. In Palestine, thinking was held subject to believing. Much of the strength of Christianity is due to its having borrowed heavily from both Hebrew morality and Greek thought.
I don't really need a comment there. We kind of have already fleshed this out there. Just what I was just saying. You can see they're reminding you of that, and when you talk about the contrast between believing and thinking, that should remind you of me telling you, it's like, these people that are in the plane and they argue about whether or not you should chase your tail clockwise around the circle, or chase your tail counterclockwise around the circle in the plane. Should you believe first and then rationalize your belief second? Or should you do it the other way around? Right?
Rationalize first and then believe.
Yeah, and then believe your rationalizations, right?
Right-handed heat and left-handed heat.
Right. And it's like, how about if we do neither of those subjective, tail chasing exercises? Right, and go up, right. But nonetheless, you've got the two elements that need to be brought together.
In Palestine, religious dogma became so crystallized as to jeopardize further growth. In Greece, human thought became so abstract that the concept of God resolved itself into a misty vapor of pantheistic speculation, not at all unlike the impersonal infinity of the Brahmin philosophers.
And we've already talked about that, you know, and even saying resolved, you know, and kind of thinking of it literally, you've loosened back, right? See, you know, the evolutionary process has been trying to bring the misty vapor to a focus, right? And if you loosen it back, you know, to its defocused misty vapor thing, right? And yeah, you're just right back to where you started. You've got all kinds of fancier ways of talking about the misty vapor than the primitives did, but you still are just trying to, you know, make something out of the misty vapor. And, you know, it's no different than people today that, you know, get way biased to their unity consciousness, you know, and want to just float on the sea of that misty vapor and bliss out, right? You know, it's you've got to find unity, but then you have to discover a new transcendent individuality above that unity. You know, to take that unity and then bring it together, right? Your personality can grab a hold of unity and ball it up into a transcendent individuality. You don't have to lose your individuality when you go up and just melt into the Brahman, you know, or whatever, or the bliss sea.
That condensation point again. Yeah. That I can encompass.
Right. Okay, so yeah, like we said way up front, so you get the same issue if you. You got to be careful about the whole personality thing, otherwise everything loses its focus and just fuzzes out into the misty vapor.
But the average men of these times could not grasp, nor were they much interested in, the Greek philosophy of self-realization and an abstract deity. They rather craved promises of salvation, coupled with a personal God who could hear their prayers. They exiled the philosophers, persecuted the remnants of the Salem cult, both doctrines having become much blended, and made ready for that terrible orgiastic plunge into the follies of the mystery cults, which were then overspreading the Mediterranean lands. The Eleusinian mysteries grew up within the Olympian pantheon, a Greek version of the worship of fertility. Dionysius nature worship flourished. The best of the cults were the Orphic Brotherhood, whose moral preachments and promises of salvation made a great appeal to many.
Okay, so just a couple things there. Notice the biting comment there towards the beginning, you know, that you got, but the average men of these times could not grasp, nor were they much interested in, the Greek philosophy of self-realization and an abstract capital D deity. They rather craved promises of salvation coupled with a personal God who could hear their prayers. It's no different today is when someone picks up the Urantia book, right? They're not looking for capital D deity, right, or self-realization. They want promises of salvation, you know, coupled with a, you know, a God who's a material technique and will answer the material technique of a prayer. That's what they want. All right, so we've come back around again to the challenge. Those who pick up the fifth epical revelation need to do everything the Greeks were doing, add the religious nucleus, though. Right? But do everything the Greeks were doing, because you need to get to deity, capital D deity. You've got to go beyond God. Right? You got to go beyond the nucleus. You got to get to the sphere. God is a religious thing there in that center point. Deity is in the spherical frame.
Can only do that through philosophy.
Yes, it's a philosophic achievement. Right? Right. The first section of the foreword philosophic section. Second section is a religious section. It's about God. First section is about deity.
But the personalized and non-personal are within that sphere together.
Yeah. Yes, they are.
Just keep it in mind.
Yes. Yeah. So it's just, it's not a, you know, don't set up any dichotomies.
Right?
You just got to, you know, but, you know, they're just reminding you here, you've got to crave, you know, more than those basic things of evolutionary religion. Okay.
You know, it's a philosophic blunder. Declaring one to be everything. Or
yeah,
another.
Right. Exactly. The Eleusinian mysteries, you know, what you're talking about there, as you might guess, when you talk about the worship of fertility. Okay, you've got Demeter, you know, the goddess of fertility. So there's the women. And then you get to Dionysus, there's the wine and the song. So you got all three. It's a complete package. You're ready for an orgiastic plunge.
Send out the
right. But like you can kind of see between the lines, you know, all of these, you know, they had some concept of salvation that was coming in. You like often you have some relationship to the underworld, right? And some bridging, you know, between above and below, you know, so there's salvation from death, you know, you can come back from the underworld. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's sort of in play in very crude fashions. And we don't need to go into the details right now, but you know, just thought I'd point out right on the surface there when they're talking about the orgiastic plunge, right? You've got wine, women, and song right up front there, and off to the races they went. Okay, what else do they give us here?
All Greece became involved in these new methods of attaining salvation, these emotional and fiery ceremonials. No nation ever attained such heights of artistic philosophy in so short a time. None ever created such an advanced system of ethics, practically without deity, and entirely devoid of the promise of human salvation. No nation ever plunged so quickly, deeply, and violently into such depths of intellectual stagnation, moral depravity, and spiritual poverty as these same Greek peoples when they flung themselves into the mad whirl of the mystery cults.
Huh, I wonder if they're telling us that because that could happen again. Right. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. And like we've talked about, if there's an interregnum, you've gotten up to a very high height, you're going to fall very far and hit really hard. They're just reminding you, this is not just a history lesson, right? This is what lies in store for those who think that somehow you can stand on the human, you know, himself, right? Humanism, right? And that you don't need a God nucleus. It'll look wonderful for a while, and then it'll crash really hard. intellectual stagnation was already, in pretty full flower by the end of the 20th century, right? It was already kind of there by the middle of the 20th century, moral depravity and spiritual poverty. Okay, yeah. I mean, all those things are just becoming more and more rampant, right? It's hard to find a church that even talks about spiritual issues. Right? They're all talking about social issues. Right? That's a spiritual poverty.
Yeah.
Salvation, while it's kind of selfish to consider one's salvation, it's dangerous to ignore it. I mean, it's...
Right. In this life before us, you serve two masters. I mean, you need to definitively sort through that salvation issue before you can take it for granted
right.
and move on to the bigger things, right? Right? If you haven't dealt with that salvation issue, there's no way you're going to get to any high level of philosophic recognition, because you can't fear not. Right? To get to the fourth level of philosophy, you have to fear not. You're going to stall out, before that. So, this is, there's so many things in the book that, are being alluded to, that you're connecting to. You can bring this all together, think very synthetically about what they're talking about here.
Religions have long endured without philosophical support, but few philosophies as such have long persisted without some identification with religion. Philosophy is to religion as conception is to action. But the ideal human estate is that in which philosophy, religion, and science are welded into a meaningful unity by the conjoined action of wisdom, faith, and experience.
Okay, so look at the order they give it to you there. So, when you think about science and religion side by side in the plane, and then philosophy above, as a super additive consequence, that triangle of three elements. If you approach it from the top down, you hit philosophy, and then they're reminding you, to deal with, get that nucleus first, and then go, to all of the subsequent details with science. Right? Even though we talked about how you need that nucleus to have the sphere around it, for all things to become new, you need to turn everything around and approach this whole issue from the top down. Because you don't just want religion, you want true religion. Okay? And the only way to guarantee the truth of religion is to start with the sphere of truth, right? And then put the religion in the center of that sphere. Otherwise, you're going to get this center point, it's going to be in a sphere of falsehood. Right, any arbitrary place you try to put it, right, is in a sphere of falsehood. So you have to find the sphere of truth first. You need to approach the problem from the top down. Okay, so that's what they're getting at. And you can even think about, they do wisdom, faith, and experience there as a triplet. But like, if you think of the reason, logic, faith. Or in this order, logic, faith, reason. Right? You start with the sphere of logic. You put the faith nucleus in it. And then once you have that faith nucleus, you can have radii of reason extending out from that faith nucleus. See how you can think of them in that order. It's going to be pretty hard to draw a radius line if you don't have the center point first. Okay. So they're trying to get you to think about how to approach this from the top down. Right? You start with philosophy, then you can have true religion and subsequently true science. Instead of false science and false religion. All right.
We're off the rails with the fancy stuff.
So all kinds of wonderful stuff there that you can go back and think about some more too. And we'll get much more into the mystery cults here in a couple of sections. We'll get into next week. But we got to bring in Rome first, as you see, before we get to the sort of the full flower of the mystery cults. We're getting close. If you flip forward, we got Mithraism and Christianity, and then we're finally done with this, the Melchizedek sequence here. So, All right, let's take a moment, everyone.